Welcome back to On the Case, the podcast. I'm Paula Zahn, and thanks for joining us for Pod 33, History Repeats Itself. Tonight, we're on the case in Aurora, Colorado. It was here in the shadows of the Rocky Mountains that Kimberly Medina vanished into thin air. The mystery surrounding the young mother's disappearance would torment her family and send police on a desperate quest for answers, a long journey to justice that would expose them to unimaginable evil. October 29, 1996. It was a cold winter evening in Aurora, Colorado, and Kimberly Medina's family had plans for a festive evening. She and her husband Michael and their two daughters were going out to dinner with Kimberly's parents before attending her younger sister Kendra's choir concert. The memory of that night remains fresh in her mind more than 20 years later.
Her and Mike and the girls were supposed to meet us there, and she didn't show up, and that wasn't normal for her. So I had called her a couple times from the restaurant, and no answer.
Kendra, just 12 years old, was crushed when her older sister also failed to show up for her performance.
When we got home, my mom called a couple times to see what was going on, and never got an answer. The phone just kept ringing and ringing and ringing.
Kendra was sure there was a simple explanation for why her sister hadn't shown up.
She never wanted anybody to worry about her, ever.
But Kendra's disappointment turned to fear the next morning when Kimberly's husband called their house thinking she was there.
Mike called my mother looking for Kimmy, which was strange.
Michael said the last time he had seen his wife was the night before when she walked out of their apartment.
He told my mom they'd gotten into an argument and she never came back.
It was crushing news, and the moment that those closest to Kimberly began to panic.
Something was wrong. Something was off.
After speaking with his wife's family, Michael contacted Kimberly's co-workers at the Denver International Airport. They added more reason for concern. Kimberly had not shown up for her shift that morning, nor called in sick. Although it appeared that Kimberly might have run away, her family insisted there was no way the devoted mother would have left without her two toddlers.
We knew something had happened to her. She would not leave Nika and Marissa behind, ever. They were her universe.
An official missing persons investigation was launched. Detective Chuck Mell of the Aurora, Colorado Police Department asked Michael Medina for a more detailed account of his wife's last known whereabouts. He said the last time he had seen her was around 10 p.m.
Mike and Kimberly Medina lived on the second floor in this apartment complex. Mike said that on the night Kimberly went missing, she walked out of the apartment in order to go get cigarettes.
Police called in a canine unit. The dog quickly picked up her trail.
The bloodhound was able to track Kimberly's scent in this direction.
Kimberly's trail went cold just beyond the gas station where she would have gone to buy cigarettes. But the clue, which appeared to confirm Michael Medina's story, ultimately added another disturbing layer to the mystery. Footage acquired from the gas station's surveillance cameras showed no sign of the missing young mother. Investigator Paul Goodman.
She never appeared on that tape, either inside the store or outside the front door of the store.
The gas station was located close to an interstate highway. Investigators knew if Kimberly had been abducted in that area, she could have been anywhere by now.
You start thinking, who took her? Who kidnapped her?
While police fanned out to canvass the neighborhood for potential witnesses, Kimberly's loved ones did whatever they could to help. Refusing to sit back and wait for police to provide answers, Kimberly's loved ones hit the streets, looking for any information on her whereabouts.
I was 12 years old, my two little brothers, going door to door, store to store, anywhere we could, passing out flyers of Kimmy.
While the search for her sister intensified, Kendra couldn't help but consider the darkest endings.
I was scared. There was so many conspiracies on what had happened, but in my mind, I thought, you know, if we found her, she would be alive out there.
Perhaps the most troubling theory surfaced after investigators spoke with Kimberly's coworkers.
They found out that Kim was possibly involved in an affair with one of her supervisors.
Detectives questioned her supervisor, Mark, and he admitted to the recently begun romance. Detective Chuck Mell.
He and Kimberly had become involved in an intimate relationship about 3 weeks prior to her disappearance.
More red flags were raised when Mark revealed the rendezvous point for their encounters.
He talked about how he met her at that gas station.
The new detail raised a troubling question. Could an illicit relationship between Kimberly Medina and the new man in her life be responsible for her disappearance? It was a possibility that was hard to ignore.
We've got somebody that's having an affair with a married woman, and that married woman disappears.
During an intense interview, Kimberly's 21-year-old boyfriend, Mark, told police he would never have done anything to hurt her. Detectives were unmoved by his emotional answers, but they were struck by the level of his cooperation.
He was very forthcoming with information. He ultimately consented to and did take a polygraph examination, which he passed.
Despite the polygraph results and a solid alibi, detectives still investigated Mark thoroughly. But investigators didn't find any evidence linking Michael to his wife's disappearance.
None whatsoever.
Mark was officially cleared as a suspect. But as police analyzed the details of Mark's account, it forced them to take a closer look at Kimberly's husband, Michael. Mark told detectives Kimberly was afraid of her husband and wanted out of her marriage.
He had informed the police that she and Mike were going to separate. Kimberly was in the process of possibly seeking a divorce from Mike.
When police spoke with Michael Medina, he told them he had no idea Kimberly was having an affair, but admitted that his marriage was on shaky ground. In fact, he told police that Kimberly had actually run away to escape the responsibilities of being a wife and mother.
What do you feel has happened to her?
I have no clue. I expected a letter, a phone call, hey, you know, leave me alone, I'm not coming back.
Investigators were skeptical and asked Michael to take a polygraph.
Tell me a reason you don't want to take a polygraph. How is it in any way detrimental to you unless you have something to hide?
The polygraph does nothing for me. My wife's missing. I had nothing to do with it.
Detectives got a search warrant for the Medina's home, hoping to find a clue that would advance their investigation. But investigators didn't find any evidence linking Michael to his wife's disappearance.
They didn't have anything to really hang their hat on.
Investigators remain suspicious of Michael, but there was no evidence Kimberly met with foul play. And as the days turned into weeks, the investigation began to stall.
There was absolutely no paper trail whatsoever after October 29th. We did everything we could to track her down. We had no idea where she was. It was very frustrating. We had nothing.
There's no workable leads at that point, no information to move it forward one way or the other.
The lack of progress on the case was incredibly painful for Kimberly's family.
There was a lot of crying.
As time went by, they began to fear they would never know the truth.
It was terrifying, not knowing who did it or what had happened to her. No, it makes you scared to be alone.
On the Case, the podcast will continue in a moment. The heartbroken family of Kimberly Medina was still searching for answers when they received another devastating blow. Her husband, Michael, who had custody of the couple's two daughters, packed up and moved, cutting all ties to his past. Kimberly's sister, Kendra Schoonover.
Michael left with the girls.
Kimberly's family was stunned.
It was like he just kind of fell off the map. My dad couldn't find him. My mom couldn't find him. We had no idea where they were. We had always been a part of their lives. And then just to be shut out like that was very sad.
It turned out that Michael was more than 200 miles away in Alamosa, Colorado, starting a new life. That's where a then 18-year-old Becky Gurrell met the single father of two young girls. The young woman was immediately impressed by Michael's devotion to his family.
He was kind of the life of the party, always, you know, laughing, having fun, joking with people.
And she loved how attentive and affectionate he was to his two young daughters.
He liked to do things, camping, fishing, mountains, having fun with them for sure. Protective, very protective. Love them.
But when it came to discussing his wife's disappearance, Michael wouldn't say much.
He didn't talk much about it. He just said that one night she went to go buy cigarettes and she never came back. There was no details. She just disappeared.
In fact, on the few occasions when Michael was actually open about his wife, the conversation ended with tears.
Whenever he'd talk about it, he would cry. He missed her.
Becky was intrigued by the 26-year-old Michael, but it was his two young daughters who she fell in love with.
Our relationship moved really fast, and so I kind of jumped into the role of mom right away.
From the start, Becky developed an incredible bond with Michael's two daughters, assuming the role as their primary caretaker.
I got close with them right away. I watched them while he worked a night job, and so they spent a lot of time at my apartment. Within the first year, they asked if they could call me Mom.
Kimberly's name was never mentioned in the home, so Becky quickly became the only mother the toddlers had ever known. And as time went on, she began to raise them as her own.
As the relationship went on, he wasn't present that often. It was mainly up to me to take care of them. I felt like they needed somebody there. That was kind of what kept the relationship going was the two girls.
Nika Medina fondly remembers when Becky first came into her life.
She used to babysit us at first. And then my dad and her started dating. She's very playful. She was my go-to.
Six years later, Becky and Michael had a baby boy. When Dagan was born, Michael's then 10-year-old daughter, Nika, became the ultimate mother's helper.
They called me his second mom because I was there for him all the time. I always wanted to hold him and feed him and put him to sleep, all that stuff. I thought it was fun.
Michael Medina also seemed thrilled by his growing family.
He seemed really happy. He had a boy, and he loved him.
On the surface, it appeared to be a happy household. But following Dagan's birth, Michael started to drink, and financial issues became a constant source of tension.
It was really hard, because Mike was gambling a lot. And so we never had money, and I just couldn't trust him, and it started getting violent. He would get physical with me.
Michael's fury steadily increased to the point where he was verbally and physically abusing Becky in front of the children.
It seemed like he was always upset or angry. I would get scared.
There were a few instances where he would grab me by the throat when we were arguing. But sometimes I had Dagan in my hands.
The situation had become so bad that Becky told Michael she was taking Dagan and moving out.
I just couldn't do it anymore. I decided to leave.
The couple's breakup was devastating for Michael's daughters, especially when they were finally told that Becky wasn't actually their biological mother.
My dad had told us that she wasn't our real mom, and that we had another mom that had disappeared. And then he did show us a picture. This is your mom.
The two girls were stunned and confused. They had no idea that Becky wasn't their biological mother.
We were like both blown away because we had no idea. It was mind-blowing. Why didn't you ever tell us what happened to her? Nobody in our family talked about it.
While Nika and Marissa struggled to absorb the shock, Becky managed to negotiate an agreement with Michael that allowed her to stay in his daughter's lives.
We had shared custody, and it was every other day, sometimes just Dagan, sometimes it was both Dagan and the girls.
During this time, Becky focused on moving on with her life, but Michael refused to let go. Every time they saw each other, Michael begged her to move back in with him.
He would try to talk to me about getting back together with him, but I finally had a job. I got my own car. Just within a month, he knew that I wasn't coming back.
Becky believed that Michael was finally coming to terms with their separation. But then, on May 20th, 2005, a routine child drop-off turned into a nightmare.
Dagan was asleep in his car seat, and Mike had me come in to get his belongings. When I walked in, he locked the door behind me. When I turned around, he put his leg up on the coffee table, and he had a buck knife in his pants.
Becky was trapped and terrified.
I was really scared. He had duct tape, gloves, handcuffs. He said, "You should have never left me."
More on The Case, the podcast, after this. As Becky struggled to comprehend what was happening, her fear turned to panic when Michael Medina threatened the life of their son, Dagan.
He said, "I have to kill him. Dagan was in his car seat on the couch. I stepped in between the two of them.
She became horrified. While Michael had abused her in the past, he had never threatened to hurt any of his children. And his disturbing behavior continued to escalate.
He just started getting worked up and pacing back and forth.
Still, Becky remained convinced that Michael would never actually harm his son.
I kept saying, I don't believe you. You would never hurt him. You love him. You know, he's your son.
Then Michael dropped a bombshell.
He said, I can prove it to you. I can and I will. I've done it before, and I got away with it.
While his two daughters slept in the next room, Medina tormented Becky with threats, including the chilling story of how he had murdered his wife, Kimberly, back in 1996.
He told me that he killed her, and I, just sat there and listened.
As Becky stood between Medina and their son, he revealed the terrifying truth about how much danger she was really in, and he shared every chilling detail of how he killed Kimberly.
He told me that they had been fighting and she had decided that she was probably going to leave. And he thought she was seeing someone at work. So while she was at her job, he had went somewhere to some field. He said, I dug a hole. I spent the day digging a hole.
Michael said that when Kimberly got home, he convinced her to take a ride with him and their daughters to the desolate area.
It was snowing. He said that he wanted her and the girls to see the snow. And so they all got in the truck. He had had a bat with him. And he said that he drove out to the spot where he dug the hole.
While the two young children slept in the back of the truck, Medina said he and Kimberly got out to talk.
When he stepped out of the truck, he slid the bat down the back of his jacket so she couldn't see it. And they walked to the spot. Because it was snowing, he slipped her hood over her head.
Medina was actually making certain that his wife couldn't see what he was about to do.
And they were standing there talking, and he told her, you should have never cheated on me. And took a step back, and he said he hit her with the bat.
Medina savagely beat Kimberly and dragged the young woman to the hole he had dug earlier that day. And then he added the story's cruelest detail.
He said that she was still alive, and he buried her. I just left her.
After the murder, Medina disposed of the evidence while his two toddlers slept in their car seats.
And he threw all of his clothes and everything in a dumpster.
Becky was terrified when Medina warned her that she would be his next victim and admitted to stalking her.
At that time, he went into his kitchen and he pulled out a notebook. It showed how he was following me around. He had, information of places that I went. He had a set of my house keys and car keys. He told me of phone conversations that I had inside my own apartment. He was sitting in my closet while I was in my own house.
Becky tried to remain calm, but she knew she was making life and death decisions. What could she say to Michael to get herself and Dagan out of the house?
I have to figure something out. I can't overpower him. I didn't know what to do. I said anything I could to try to get him to back down. We can work this out. We can talk.
As the sun rose the next morning, Becky came up with a plan. She told Medina that her aunt was expecting her, and if she didn't show up soon, it would raise suspicion.
And I said, if I don't go, she's going to wonder where I'm at.
Medina agreed to let Becky go, But the price of her freedom was unimaginable.
He was like, yeah, you sure, you can go, but he can't.
Medina was pointing to their 16-month-old son, Dagan, and he made it clear to Becky that if she told anyone about her night of terror, she would never see their little boy again. Despite her fear, Becky still believed it was her life in danger, not Dagan's.
I had to make that choice. I had to get help.
Becky had no choice but to leave Dagan behind with his father. It was a heart-wrenching decision.
It was the worst feeling ever.
When Becky arrived at her aunt's home, she was unable to hide her emotions.
She is a victim's advocate with the sheriff's office. I told her what happened.
Becky's aunt convinced her that calling the sheriff's department was her only option. Law enforcement quietly set up a perimeter around Medina's home without revealing their position. Sergeant Rick Needham.
The situation was dire.
I called in our SWAT team. We had eyes on the house.
Minutes later, Medina contacted Becky. It seemed he was aware that she had revealed his secret to police.
He's calling me on the phone. You should have never told them. He just kept saying that you should have never told them.
Throughout the afternoon, the frantic phone calls continued. Investigator Paul Goodman.
I charted out probably 100 phone calls.
He would say, I told you not to leave. Why are you going to make me do this? Now I have to do this. And it was very short phone calls. And then he would hang up.
The conversation led Becky to believe that Michael may have reached the point of no return.
He sounded agitated, very frustrated and upset with me, just saying the same things. This is your fault. Don't make me do this. Now I have to do this. You should have never told them.
Medina's words alarmed the SWAT team and Becky.
He let me talk to Dagan. And he had him tell me. He let him tell me goodbye. And he said, say goodbye to your mom. Say bye, my mama. And he did. He said, bye, mama.
Investigators believed it was time to put their plan into motion.
My staff was chomping at the bit.
We were getting ready to go hit the house. It's time to go.
But as the SWAT team descended on Medina's home, they made a shocking discovery. The house had been empty all morning. Medina, Dagan, and his two daughters were already on the run.
Unbeknownst to us and to the sheriff's department, Mike had called his brother and asked for a ride. Mike and the girls got in his vehicle and left the scene. So we were watching an empty house for several hours.
Authorities quickly got an update on Medina's whereabouts from his two frightened daughters, who had been picked up by their uncle near a playground 20 miles from their home. Nika revealed the traumatizing series of events that led to her call. It started when her father woke her up and insisted she help get the rest of the family ready for a trip.
He told me to get my sister up and that we were going to leave. He just seemed very panicky. He kept running back and forth to the living room and the bedroom. He was talking on the phone to my uncle.
Nika told officers about the call she had overheard between her father and Becky that morning, and he seemed extremely agitated.
Just upset, just angry, yelling on the phone.
According to Nika, her dad took them to a nearby park where she and her sister played with Dagan.
We played at the park while he was on the phone.
Mika told police that at the end of his last call with Becky, her father made a shocking statement.
He sat us down and he said that him and Dagan were going on a trip and that only him and Dagan could go and that we had to stay behind. They needed a boys' trip.
Nika and her sister were confused, but Medina offered no other details. He wouldn't even say how long he and Dagan would be gone.
When we asked, he said, I don't know yet. He's like, but I'll send you postcards and gifts and stuff for your birthdays. And I was really upset. Why can he go? Why can't we go with you?
Then Medina told his daughters to say goodbye to their baby brother. Nika had no idea she would never see her baby brother again.
I was really sad. I kind of just gave him a hug.
Medina told his daughters to walk up the street and call their uncle to take them home.
He said, when you leave, you don't look back. You don't tell anybody where we are.
On the Case, the podcast will continue in a moment. Later that same day, Vic Lucero and his family were harvesting asparagus on his property, not far from that same park where he heard his wife let out a blood-curdling scream.
And so I ran over here, and there was a baby laying right there. I checked it for vital signs, and there were none.
Vic immediately called 911. When investigators arrived, they were devastated. It was the lifeless body of 16-month-old Dagan Medina. Investigator Paul Goodman.
They found the baby wrapped in a gray sweatshirt. He was wet.
Sergeant Rick Needham.
It was sad. There were a lot of guys that were on the verge of tears. It was tough. We didn't protect this little boy.
Based on the condition of the body, police theorized he had drowned. As detectives canvassed the area, they found more disturbing evidence that supported that theory.
The diaper was found next to the water. It was soaking wet.
Officers also discovered a trail of footprints left by an adult that led into the stream.
They were kind of muddy in the water. You could see where somebody would have walked, stopped, and then walked out.
Meanwhile, police spoke with Vic Lucero, the witness who had discovered Dagan's body. And he provided them with another critical detail. He had crossed paths with a stranger wandering around his property earlier that day. Vic said the man had been on foot and asked for a lift into town.
I agreed to give him a ride to at least the edge of town and dropped him off there.
Based on the description Vic gave, investigators believed that man had been Michael Medina. While officers fanned out to find him, other detectives had a much more difficult task, notifying Becky Gorrell that her son Dagan was dead.
Nobody would even look at me. They told me that a farmer found a body.
Becky broke the shocking news to Michael's daughter, Nika.
They didn't know what was going on. They were so little, they didn't understand. You could see it in their eyes. I had to tell them what happened.
Nika remains tormented by that moment.
It just seemed like time stopped. What do you mean he's dead? We just literally just saw them an hour or two ago. We were like, no, they went on a trip. What are you talking about? It was hard.
Within hours, state patrol officers arrested Michael Medina, hitchhiking along a nearby highway.
They found him several blocks away. I was told that he was calm, cool, collected. He didn't tell the officers anything. He didn't make any statements.
Vic Lucero confirmed that Medina was the man he had seen on his property.
I identified that that was, in fact, the person that had been up here.
Michael Medina was charged with first-degree murder. And for those who were at the scene, it was hard to imagine a more evil crime.
He's a monster. There's no getting around it. I often thought what it would be like if you were digging and you're being pushed under the water and your last vision is that of your father shoving you under the water as you're gasping for air. It's incomprehensible to me how anybody could do that to anyone, really, but a baby, I mean, 16 months old, and your own.
As the trial approached, Medina tried to defend his actions. He told prosecutors that Dagan's death had been an accident. He claimed his son had fallen into the stream while he was distracted.
Michael's story was that he was busy on the phone and Dagan accidentally wandered off.
Becky was repulsed by Michael's version of events.
It was horrible the way he described it. He described in detail how Dagan died, that he fell into the water. I was mad. I was angry. Because he was lying, you know. He was lying.
But prosecutors thought that it was possible a jury might believe Medina's story. They believed that even a small chance of an acquittal was still too great of a risk to take. Eventually, the 33-year-old agreed to plead guilty to child abuse resulting in death and received a sentence of 48 years. The plea deal didn't sit well with investigator Paul Goodman.
I thought his plea should have been to a murder count, not a child abuse resulting in death, because that sounds kind of innocent. That can be something as simple as not supervising your child, letting them get out of the house, they walk into traffic.
Following his conviction, Becky Garrell was granted custody of Medina's two daughters, and they struggled to overcome their pain as a family.
The girls really had a big part of getting me through with that because I had someone else to live for. I don't think I could have by myself. They saved my life. I don't know how to put it into words. I love them so much.
For Nika and her sister, the feeling is mutual. In many ways, Becky is the only mother they have ever known.
She asked us why we would want to stay with her, and I was like, well, you've been our mom for so long. I feel like it's right to stay with you. Because I think of her as my hero. I think she's amazing.
With Michael Medina behind bars, prosecutors decided to take a hard look at the confession he made to Becky about murdering his wife Kimberly back in 1996. Prosecutor Jason Sears.
Everything about the statement just rang true. It had credibility.
Still, Deputy District Attorney Jason Sears knew the case would be challenging. There was no crime scene, no physical evidence. Even proving Kimberly was dead would be a hurdle he had to cross.
We didn't have a body. We didn't have a murder weapon. We didn't have a scene. We didn't know any of those details. We knew this case really rested on Becky, whether the juries believed her, but we knew if they believed her, we had a good chance because the story is just so compelling.
Finding evidence that supported what Medina had told Becky would also be critical.
when you boil it down, this case came down to us building evidence to show that what he said was in fact true.
There were several elements of Medina's account that Sears believed would be central, like the freshly fallen snow he had used to lure Kimberly to take a ride.
The description of the weather is such a very specific detail. He's either the best fiction writer in the world, or this is something he experienced.
And when prosecutors checked the weather from that day, they were stunned to see that the details of Michael's murderous account were actually accurate.
It did snow that night in Aurora, Colorado, on October 29th, 1996.
Investigators continued to piece together the small details.
He talked about how he pulled the hoodie over her head. He actually was able to describe the jacket she was wearing was a Mickey Mouse jacket.
Once again, detectives found evidence that supported Medina's story.
And we were able to find home videos that Kimberly did in fact have a hoodie with a Mickey Mouse symbol on it that matched the description he gave.
But at trial, prosecutors knew it would be Becky Gorell's terrifying account that would have to sway a jury. Becky would be forced to relive the most tormenting moments of her life from the witness stand.
I can't imagine anyone going through what she's gone through and coming out the other side. She is such an example of strength, perseverance, and just the ability to overcome.
It was hard because I knew that I would have to go through it all again. Kimmy's dad was there. I had to tell the story with him listening, so that was hard too.
It was the first time those closest to Kimberly would hear the sickening details of her last moments alive. For Kimberly's sister, Kendra, it was almost too much to bear.
I couldn't even catch my breath. It was very hard when I learned the details of what he had actually done to her. It's like I just keep reliving it in my head. It's like staring at your nightmares.
But Becky never wavered. She knew that Kimberly's daughters, the girls she had raised, were counting on her.
The girls were there. I looked at them a lot.
She said that their presence in the courtroom gave her the strength to persevere.
I saw what all this has done to them, and you know, I just wanted to do what was right.
The trial was heartbreaking for Michael Medina's daughters. Nika hadn't spoken with her father in 8 years. The last contact she had had with him was on the day he killed her brother.
I just told myself I had to be strong. This is for Dagan, and this is for Kim.
Through it all, Michael Medina sat stone-faced as Becky told her heartbreaking story.
He had a smirk on his face the whole time. No crying, no emotion, but just made me feel angry.
On November 15th, 2013, 17 years after Kimberly Medina's disappearance, her husband Michael was convicted of first-degree murder. He was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
It was relief hearing guilty. Finally, some justice for Kimmy. Finally, we get a little peace, a little bit of justice for her. It was a big moment for my family. He caused a world of pain.
Despite the verdict, Kimberly's loved ones still have many unanswered questions. They want to know where Michael Medina buried Kimberly.
I don't think he'll ever tell us where she is. It's his one last thing that he can control. I wish he would tell us. Let us put her to rest. I don't think he will.
Kimberly's daughters, Nika and Marissa, have tried their best to move forward. They focus on honoring the memory of those they lost at the hands of their father, a mother they never knew, and a younger brother who they loved so very much.
I know when it's her birthday or her passing day, her dad will call me and we'll talk. For Dagan's, we go down to his burial site and we release balloons.
Kimberly's family is grateful to Becky Gorell, whose courage and love have allowed Marissa and Nika to thrive despite the tragedies.
I'm proud of who they are, and I know Kimmy would be too. She wanted to raise strong, beautiful women. That was probably Kimmy's number one goal in life. Becky's an amazing woman. It just shows you that the worst can happen to you and you can still thrive.
Becky Gorell has continued to rebuild her life. She is now happily married, raising two young children. We wish her the very best. Thanks for listening. Please don't forget to follow, rate, and review. And if you want more information on today's case, visit facebook.com/PaulaZahn Official or just click the link in the episode description. I'm Paula Zahn. Please join us again next Wednesday when we're back on the case, the podcast.